content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ann Jordan for the North Carolina Reading Service, and welcome to Oprah Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah.com. All right, this article is called After My Mother's Plastic Surgery, I Couldn't Recognize Her. I was 34 when my mother changed her face. Too old for tantrums, but that didn't stop me from having one. Not in front of her. Even I wasn't that self-centered. But among my friends. The softness around her eyes and cheeks was gone, replaced by taut skin and sculpted cheekbones. Looking at pictures, my friends declared her beautiful, but I couldn't get past that she looked different. The face I had loved since childhood, that I had gazed at during story and mealtimes, and that had calmed me when I was anxious about a test or later a job interview, was gone. Just looking at my mother's face had conjured lullabies and the kisses she bestowed nightly until I moved out of the house. But now that she had altered it, I mourned what was gone. Rightly or wrongly, I felt it had belonged partly to me. She hadn't told me she was going to do it. We lived in different states by then. She slipped quietly into the hospital and hid as she healed. When I saw her for the first time after the surgery, I was shocked. I recognized her silky champagne pantsuit, the colorful scarf she often wore, but not the woman wearing them. I stared as you would stare at an Elvis impersonator, looking for differences and similarities. She was waiting for me to say something, to acknowledge the improvement, perhaps, but I couldn't. My breath was stopped in my chest. My eyes were hot. She lived in Los Angeles, where plastic surgeons are as easy to find as struggling actors. Divorced, she had put a profile on J-Date and was seeing two men. "I thought you told me online dating wasn't safe," I said. "It isn't safe for you." It had been years since she and my father had ended their marriage, though when she called his office, she still confused the secretaries by announcing herself as his wife. I was relieved she was finally moving on. Years before, when I was on the Atkins diet, she had fried steaks for me for breakfast. Once, after I complimented her earrings, she had taken them off and given them to me. When I was growing up, my father had often been impatient with her. "Study," he had shouted in response to a question she asked about the Torah, though he could have easily answered it. I had never seen them kiss. But a facelift. The feminist in me should have been offended by the thought of it. I am a person who refuses to wear heels and whose daily routine does not include makeup. I left the Orthodox Jewish community I was raised in because women were relegated to the back of the synagogue. Yet the truth is, I was not thinking about the oppression of women. I was simply missing my mother's face. I still thought of her in terms of her relationship to me. Years earlier, she had moved from East Coast to West Coast, leaving me behind. I had felt abandoned, though I was an adult by then, living in my own apartment and working in publishing, and we hadn't been seeing much of each other. I struggled to see the move as the new start that it was for her. She swapped a wardrobe of New York black for one of L.A. white, a change that mirrored her improved look and outlook. My mother was someone who was constantly striving, earning a master's degree in social work after her four children were grown, then a doctoral degree in psychology. She had her own work and her own friends. What she did with her body was her own business, but it was hard for me to see it that way. I wasn't entirely selfish when it came to our relationship. Over the phone, I helped her learn to use a computer. I gave her feedback on academic papers. "What kind of shoes should I wear to ride a motorcycle?" she asked me once, and I sent her an online link to a pair of biker boots, wondering who she planned to ride with. Perhaps if I had had my own children, I would have understood the tension between her identity as an independent woman and as a mother. That as much as she loved me, she had the business of her own life to get to, business that couldn't wait anymore. It wasn't until I grew older, and my mother had passed, that bags appeared under my eyes, and gravity began to take its toll on my body. I began to notice youth all around me, not in L.A., but in Boulder, Colorado, the university town where I now live. and I began to appreciate her desire to turn the clock back. Like my mother, I got divorced in midlife and began dating again. I joined Match.com and eHarmony and discovered that men my age were looking for younger women, and men decades older thought that I would be a good partner for them. When I didn't get asked on a second date, I'd wonder if it was because I was overweight or that I no longer looked young, even if I didn't quite look old yet either. I remarried after nearly a decade, relieved to put dating behind me. I don't see plastic surgery in my future, but if the facelift made my mother feel more attractive, made dating or going out into the world easier, I'm glad she got it. I wish I had told her she looked beautiful. I wish we had talked about what dating in midlife was like, while we still had a chance to talk about that and other things. We never did talk about the surgery. Anything I would have said when she first got it would have been hurtful. Over time, I accepted the change in the way she looked. She was the same loving woman that she had always been, her kindness not limited to my family. She waived therapy fees for those who couldn't afford them, gathered donated supplies for a woman who was moving from a homeless shelter to an apartment, stood up in court to support a client who couldn't afford a lawyer, much to the displeasure of the judge. When I think about her now, those are the things I remember, as well as the way she greeted me at her apartment door, her hands on my cheeks and joy in her eyes. The last time I visited her, before an accident took her from us. My mother never wanted to grow old, and she never did. She was 66 and still as active as she had ever been at 20 or 40 when she died. At the time, she was talking about getting a second facelift, which would have been fine with me, because as it turned out, it was never really her face that I loved. And it isn't her face that I miss, it's her heart. All right, this article is called "These Parents Finally Had Empty Nest, and Then Their Kids Came Home to Quarantine." Many college students were in the middle of spring semesters in March when their campuses were closed due to the coronavirus pandemic. Millennials, several years removed from school, fled big cities like New York and San Francisco as shelter-in-place orders descended. No matter their education or job status, a majority headed to one common destination to socially distance: their parents' house. Living under mom and dad's roof was a big adjustment, to be sure, and not just for kids. In the U.S., there are approximately 22.5 million couples with fully grown children who live outside of their homes, aka empty nesters, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Before the coronavirus pandemic, these couples, typically between 50 and 70 years old, had finally gotten to the stage where they'd gotten used to domestic life without their kids. Now, some of these parents have found themselves having to ditch their new normals. As more families were suddenly finding their nest a lot cozier, I spoke with 14 parents and 5 adult children to hear how they're handling quarantining together. While it's clear the love is there, there's been no shortage of squabbles, privacy issues, and awkward moments. The biggest challenge? Boundaries. "We've been empty nesters for years, and now there's no privacy unless I go sit in my car," says Deborah Klein, a 55-year-old certified health coach in Massachusetts. While Klein's 26-year-old daughter made a quick decision to stay at her parents' house after her roommates left her apartment, Klein's son, 25, resisted coming home at first. But after a difficult conversation with his mom, who wasn't thrilled he was still playing basketball and going to bars during the pandemic, he finally returned. "I forgot that everyone can hear everything in our house," she says, "so we bought white noise machines for each bedroom." And there's a photo of the Klein family out for a hike on a sunny day. Retired Detroit-based TV meteorologist Chris Edwards tells me that on a Zoom call for a friend's 60th birthday, he momentarily forgot his youngest daughter was home when he told an off-color story about his alone time. His 20-year-old daughter covered her ears, shouting, "How can I unhear that?" It's clear the discomfort goes both ways. Rachel Osman, 23, in Reading, Pennsylvania, tells me, "My mom's home office shares a wall with the bathroom, so every time she's in a meeting, I have to text her to see if it's okay to flush." And when Jasmine Green, 21, returned home to Houston, Texas, after Wake Forest University closed, she made the unfortunate mistake of opening a saucy Snapchat message. "I didn't realize my mom was behind me," says Green. "I hid my phone and then I played the music and danced to defuse the situation." Safe to say, I no longer open snaps from specific people. In addition to relearning privacy etiquette with their children, parents are also overwhelmed with another stressor: the added amount of food prep and cleanup required when there's a full house. "We had to set up a plan so that everyone takes a turn making dinner and cleaning," says Christine Moffitt, 51, who's isolating in Westchester, New York. Once everyone knew their job, it was much smoother. Ken Zeng, who is quarantining in Lumberton, New Jersey with his wife and their 19-year-old college freshman daughter and their 22-year-old son, notes, "Our food bill has certainly increased, and our dishwasher is stunned after having it easy for the last 7 months." There is some upside to the new dinner schedules, however, as some millennials are teaching their parents to get more adventurous with their meals. Whitney, age 29, is a freelance food writer who relocated to New York. Her Caucasian parents adopted her from Korea, so she only began to cook with Asian ingredients after leaving home. Though her parents are the pickiest people, she's been having fun over the last few weeks expanding their palates. "I did an Instagram live demo of Vietnamese caramel chicken, and I convinced my parents to try a bite. They not only tried it, but loved it and requested that I make it for them next week," she says. "Now every day when I make myself brunch, like soft scrambled eggs over rice, breakfast tacos, or savory grits, my mom has voluntarily tasted it and enjoyed it." And there's a photo of Whitney with her parents at a museum. For many families, there's another quite literal issue with bandwidth: Wi-Fi. College classes, Zoom conference calls, Netflix binge watching, and gaming are taking over household networks. Zeng, for instance, says his brood recently had to make sure they were all logged off the internet so their youngest child could take a timed online test. Similarly, Suzanne, 54, and her husband, both high school English teachers, found themselves struggling with prioritizing video conferences after their two college-aged sons came home to Beverly Hills, Michigan. For these two different generations, sleep schedules can also cause chaos as parents retire to bed early while their kids stay up until the wee hours of the morning. Maryland-based anesthesiologist Dr. Daniela Wiggins, 48, often goes to bed with her husband around 11 p.m., and that's when their children, home from Spelman College and Brown University, finally emerge from their bedrooms, making noise in the kitchen as they hop online for Netflix watch parties or Zoom gatherings. "My husband has taken to texting them to be quiet, and not always politely," she says. But beyond Wi-Fi conundrums and dinner planning, for many of these parents, what concerns them the most is seeing their children cope with their new, unsure reality. Or, as Moffitt puts it, the fact that their lives have been turned upside down. Several of the adults I spoke with noted their children are feeling depressed because they're missing out on cap and gown graduations, or they've been ripped away from their friends, or simply because they went from living independently to being confined to their childhood bedroom. Moffitt's own daughter is a senior at Berklee College of Music in Boston. "She was extremely emotional about her senior year coming to an end the way it did," she says. "At the time, my husband and I laid off two employees and reduced our salaries to keep our business going. There was a lot of frustration. No one here was meditating or doing puzzles, that's for sure." Meanwhile, Miller's oldest son, a senior at the University of Michigan, is worried about his future in the face of huge economic uncertainties, and she often finds herself feeling guilty because of that. "Should I have encouraged him to stay at school with his housemates and finish his senior year? Would my sophomore son be more productive if he stayed in his dorm room?" She wonders about that. "I think every parent is stressed and just not sure what the right choice is in all of this, but we are doing our best." For any empty nesters trying to figure out their new normal, Julie Hames, author of How to Raise an Adult, recommends starting with the family meeting to talk about how roles and expectations have changed since they were last living under your roof. She also adds that giving your child space while checking in every few days is helpful. Avoid giving advice. Your greatest gift to your children is your presence, coupled with empathy. It might help to summon a memory of fear or loss you experienced when you were their age, and then share how you felt then. She also acknowledges that while parents may act as their children's role models, mom and dad also need to remember that they themselves are struggling too. Try to focus on the things you can control, your own actions and responses. Then practice self-care. Put your own oxygen mask on first, so to speak. Bickering over Wi-Fi, dishes, and bathroom access aside, the biggest theme I saw amongst the parents and children I spoke to was gratitude for the extended time together. O'Connell, 54, recently relocated to Cumming, Georgia from New Jersey. When her three kids returned home during the quarantine, they spent time answering prompts in a journal that her son had given her for her birthday. Chrissy Triano, 51, plays cornhole, ping pong, and even beer pong with her son, daughter, and husband. Others are learning TikTok dances with their kids or printing out AFI's top 100 films list to select movies to watch together. When Moffitt's 51st birthday happened during the quarantine, she and her family donned formal dresses, blasted music, and lit sparklers in the driveway. While it's odd to be at home at 28 years old, I'm grateful to be here instead of thousands of miles away worrying about them, says Vito Gallo, a public relations employee who's currently residing in Litchfield, Connecticut with his immigrant parents. While these sons and daughters miss their independent lifestyles, retreating to a safe space with the people they love is the ultimate solace right now. I think being around familiar things from your childhood can be comforting during these stress-filled times, said Roxy Jackson, 63, in Georgia. My 21-year-old daughter and my husband now enjoy lunch together nearly every day. Jackson's daughter says, I'm thankful I have parents who will let me be a baby sometimes. Patty, age 59, in Hermosa Beach, California, laughed when she saw her 28 and 23-year-old's quarantine grocery list were filled with requests for Nutter Butters, Little Smokies, and Pillsbury cookie dough. I realized these were things they liked as little kids, and it was their comfort food, she says. I look at this period as a true gift. This will probably be the last time I have both of my kids under the same roof, so I'm personally enjoying every minute of them. Here's what O readers are most thankful for this year. Although the world may seem wobbly, we can steady ourselves by focusing on the things that we are so grateful for. My 6-year-old peers intently at the laptop screen, brow deeply furrowed. His grandfather, thousands of miles away, is showing off his vast collection of historical dolls. Action figures, he always protests. They're action figures, not dolls. Edgar Allan Poe, 5 inches tall, stares suspiciously at a plastic raven on his shoulder. A knitted Leonardo da Vinci flops at his easel. My father holds up a figure with a familiar gray bouffant, handbag dangling from one crooked elbow. Do you know who this is? He asks. My son shakes his head, transfixed. It's Queen Elizabeth II. Look at her sensible shoes and her teeny little hand waving. I'll show you how it's done. I watch as the pair of them royally wave to each other over Skype. Every night, this is our pre-bedtime ritual. I wash the dishes to the sounds of my son asking my dad, the professor, questions about historical minutiae. Do pirates hate land? Who invented the holes in cheese? Have you ever seen a pyramid? No equation can render these pandemic days equal to the life that we had before. Like many people around the world, in almost every measurable way, my family is faring worse. We're trapped in a country apart from our entire extended family in Canada. My little sister has a newborn baby I've never met. My son, an only child, has spent months playing on his own. I have a delicate immune system, which makes public spaces an obstacle course of anxiety. I can't enter a grocery store or risk sitting on an outdoor patio with friends. Taken one by one, these realities are almost bearable. But taken all together, they feel overwhelming as our world has grown smaller and our time is used up day by day. The unspoken fear. Are we wasting our precious hours? In these long stretches of uncertainty, we're trapped by our fragile bodies, our commitments, our dependence, our financial resources, our geography. Life has shrunk to the size of the room we're in, but when the world is no longer wide, it may be deep. There's something I learned 4 years ago during my first encounter with a life stripped to the studs when I was diagnosed at age 35 with stage 4 colon cancer. It was a practice that started in waiting rooms and chemotherapy infusion chairs. Through blurry days and nights, a little habit grew. I began to notice the bizarre beauty of small details. My son's eyelashes, so thick that I could count them one by one. The smell of the warm blanket the nurse brought while I was sitting in a chair being pumped full of chemicals. How frost on autumn leaves makes the perfect crunch. The shadows outside beginning to lengthen, softening the long North Carolina day into a deeper night. Gratitude is the child of attention. When we stop to take in what's before us, a single moment becomes suddenly divisible into thousands. As theologian and mental health nurse John Swinton writes, there is fast time and there is slow time. Fast time is deadlines and efficiency and work weeks. Slow time moves at the speed of love. What's that my dad just said about cheese? My father has moved on to doing an impression. Maybe it's Yosemite Sam? There's a giant mustache involved. The counters are wiped, and for a second, the house looks almost clean. Now that I think of it, there is still ice cream left in the freezer. This moment. The more I linger, the deeper it grows. And now we have O readers on what they're most grateful for. Susan Wilkinson says, my hardships. 20 years ago, I came to the U.S. from Uganda without much. I worked as an ER secretary and admissions clerk to save enough money for school. And now I'm a psychiatry and mental health nurse practitioner with a thriving private practice. To know I am one generation removed from child marriage is humbling, to say the least. Kelly says 41 years of sobriety. Annette James says, a life I couldn't have imagined a year ago. I went from a happy, zero-kid, big-city existence to living in a small town and being a loving, supportive presence to my 6 nieces and nephews who lost their mom to breast cancer in December. Out of this tragedy has come so much meaning. I'm grateful to hold both its sadness and its beauty in my heart. Bernadette says Spanx and salt and pepper. Alicia Fetters says, the Chicago Lakefront Trail. Running there, feeling the wind on my face, watching the waves, makes everything okay. I'm particularly thankful for the geese. Their badass attitude inspires me to be more confident in myself. Jenny says, plants and the planet. Food and fungus, awakenings and awe, tea and tiny things. Michelle says, my almost 19-year-old dog, Neo. He is nearly blind and limps with arthritis, but every day he gets himself out of his bed and he wags his tail and he eats and runs. Everything I know about gratitude I learned from my warrior dog. Lois says, turning 94 years old, my neighbor's homegrown squash, hearing I love you at the end of a phone call, and Stephen Colbert's fluffy hair. Dana says, finding my daughter 35 years, 8 months, and 10 days after I surrendered her for adoption. She had her Ancestry.com kit for 13 months before she finally turned it in on January 3rd of this year. On January 4th, I happened to look on the site, and there she was. Now I'm finally reconnecting with her and her birth father. Cadden says, New York City parks. This year they were magical, hawks perching close by, the most extraordinary sunsets, everything in full bloom. Mother Nature truly transformed herself during this pandemic, and those of us who have taken this as an opportunity to awaken have most certainly been transformed as well. Jennifer Willis says, technology. I'm a federal defender. In mid-March, federal jails stopped allowing lawyer visits, and our court went 3 months without holding in-person appearances. If this pandemic had come on 10 or even 5 years ago, I don't know how I could have continued representing my clients. COVID has made representation more important than ever. In jail, conditions are crowded and unhygienic, which made it impossible to take proper measures to slow the spread of the virus. Instead, people were shut in their cells all day, no visits, no hot meals, and days without a shower. In April, one of my clients got very sick, likely with COVID. He was placed in even more restrictive quarantine and given little treatment. Later, he told me he had never felt so sick and feared he would die alone. With technology, at least I can let my clients know that they have someone on their side, even during a pandemic, and we're still working to get them home. Charlene says, the kidney I gave my husband on June 30th, 2015. Edith says my grandmother Zipora, a midwife in Poland during the 1918 pandemic. Because of her good health and safety practices, my entire family is alive today. Danielle says, insulin, a pump, and a blood sugar monitor. These three things help keep my 14-year-old daughter alive, and for that, I am beyond grateful. Neil says, vodka. Renita says, a mom who could stretch a dollar bill and make six children think the dish she called ushadashawashkichish was a delicacy, when in fact it was all she had in the refrigerator, onions, butter, potatoes, and hot dogs. She died in May, but we carry on the ushadashawashkiti legacy by sharing food with the hungry and with family and friends who sit at our tables. And lastly, Paul Grimes says, talking to the bush and flowers I planted outside my apartment window. At the end of the day, I have a glass of wine with them. They're like pets, but I don't have to walk them. This article is called 26 Unique Thanksgiving Tradition Ideas Your Family and Friends Will Love. Think outside of pumpkin pie. There are a few essentials for every Thanksgiving celebration. Family, friends, festive tunes, a few bottles of wine, tasty cocktails, an even tastier menu, pie. Beyond that, well, it's up to you. Over the years, your family has probably developed some special traditions associated with Turkey Day, from the food you serve for Thanksgiving dinner, hello, Grandma's famous gravy recipe, to what you do pre- and post-feast. This year's festivities, though, are bound to look a little different in light of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic and social distancing. Yes, you might have to skip a few of your oldest traditions, but that also makes it the perfect time to add a few activities that you haven't done over and over again. Ahead, we've compiled a list of our favorite modern Thanksgiving traditions, and not all are about food. Kick off the day with a turkey trot, or, if you're like us, a Bloody Mary bar. Host a post-dinner virtual game night, set up a call with your furthest-flung loved ones, and much more. Whether you're celebrating Thanksgiving with friends, as a family, or just as a couple, all of these ideas for Thanksgiving traditions celebrated across the country are sure to make you count your blessings and feel more grateful than ever. Write down what you're thankful for. In all the fun and frenzy, it can be easy to forget the true meaning of Thanksgiving, which is gratitude. Indulge in a pie breakfast. Instead of starving yourself until 3 p.m., start the day right and expand your stomach a little with a pie breakfast. Invite guests to bring their favorites. Set up a Bloody Mary bar. While the dinner's roasting and baking, set out a Bloody Mary bar so guests can make their own brunch classic as they mingle. Bonus points for over-the-top garnishes, like bacon, shrimp, and lobster. Collect canned goods. It's only natural to demonstrate gratitude by trying to give back on Thanksgiving. But instead of volunteering at a soup kitchen, many of which are overrun on that single day, but then forgotten about later, why not invite your guests to each bring canned foods to donate? Organize an ornament exchange. When Santa's sleigh appears at the end of the Macy's parade, the festive holiday season officially begins. For those who celebrate Christmas, invite each Thanksgiving guest to bring an ornament to exchange to kick off the holidays and to keep the joy going through December. Host a Thanksgiving potluck. There's no need to spend hours in the kitchen solo. Everybody's got their superstar recipe, the one passed down through the generations or borrowed from friends that they swear by. Get guests into the fun by inviting everybody to bring their best dish. As long as you've got all the major bases covered, who says you can't have four different types of stuffing? Ask everyone to make a toast. A twist on the popular "everybody say what you're thankful for," encourage each guest around the table to stand up and make their own Thanksgiving toast, reflecting on the previous year. Here are some Thanksgiving quotes to get everyone started. Send guests home with leftovers. Thanksgiving dinner is the meal that keeps on giving, especially if, like us, you always end up with a mountain of extra food. To avoid feeling overwhelmed by the leftovers filling your fridge, send each guest home with a few leftovers. Ask each person to bring their own container so that you don't spend the rest of the year chasing down yours. Let the kids serve dessert. Why should adults have all the fun? Get your kids in on the action by inviting them to serve dessert. Better yet, let them help make a pie and serve their own tasty creations, alongside more professional offerings too, of course. Try a new recipe. Who says Thanksgiving demands stuffing, mashed potatoes, and cranberry sauce? This year, spice things up and replace one holiday staple with something a little bit out of the ordinary. From delicious dishes that celebrate your strong cultural ties to family favorite recipes passed down through the generations, the holiday is the perfect time to reflect on your hopes and aspirations for the coming year. Go for a post-dinner walk. Walking together after dinner not only burns off all those gravy calories, but it allows you to slow down and savor the moment together, perfect for making room before returning for dessert. Share beloved family stories. Ask a few of your older relatives to share some family stories. This activity will not only fill the evening with laughter and possibly tears, but it will also create deeper bonds that last long beyond the holidays. According to Emory University's Family Narratives Lab, families that know and tell family stories are emotionally closer and report stronger connections than families that don't know or tell these kinds of tales. Staying on the fall theme, here's an article about easy fall cocktails to warm you on chilly nights. Hot buttered bourbon. Whip up a big batch of bourbon batter, a combination of butter, sugar, maple syrup, and warm spices, so you can have a warm, toasty cocktail whenever the mood strikes. Spiced apple rum punch. If you're hosting a harvest dinner, you can create a signature cocktail for the crowd without diverting too much attention from the main meal. This big batch punch requires just 3 ingredients: rum, apple juice, and ginger beer. Cranberry cobbler smash. Bourbon, cranberry, and cinnamon simple syrup come together to create a distinctly fall beverage that's elevated enough for your holiday table and can be made ahead of the meal. Nutty apple martini. For the ultimate fall martini, swap plain vodka for a pecan-infused spirit. Pair it with apple cider, some warm spices, and a hint of maple syrup. Spiced mulled wine. For a simple cocktail that will make your whole house smell like fall, simmer red wine with the warm spices and hint of citrus. Red wine apple cider fall sangria. Like your favorite sangria, but better. Thanks to in-season apples, tart cranberries, bright pomegranate, and zesty cinnamon. For an added zip, stir in a hint of rum or bourbon. The choice is entirely yours. It's the perfect make-ahead option since the flavor enhances it as it sits. Pear Manhattan. If you've had your fill of apples and pumpkin spice, try this twist on a classic. It's made with most of the same ingredients as your standard Manhattan, but it gets a seasonal spin from pear brandy. This next article is called Oprah Personally Called Voters in Texas to Help Figure Out Their Voting Plans. Okay, so picture it. The phone rings, you answer. On the other line, you hear a familiar voice saying, "Hi, it's Oprah Winfrey." Well, this week, a few eligible voters in Texas were treated to the surreal experience of speaking to the one and only Lady O. The day before early voting opened in Texas, Oprah cold-called voters to make sure that they had plans for casting a ballot in the 2020 presidential election. She was volunteering with former Governor Beto O'Rourke's organization called Powered by People. Oprah said, "Since I can't go knocking on people's doors this election, I spent today talking with Beto O'Rourke and calling Texas voters to make sure that they have a voting plan." That's what she actually wrote in her Instagram caption, alongside a video of her first call to a voter. The post captures the surprise of the person answering the phone. She says, "I just want to confirm, is this really Oprah? After all, it's not every day one gets to chat with a living legend." Oprah's calls with the Texas voters provide a model for the conversation about voting that we should all be having with our friends and family. Studies have shown that talking about voting with others can get them to the polls. In fact, according to research by Vote With Me, it's 20 times more effective than asking strangers to vote. Christian, the first name of a voter Oprah spoke to in Texas, is a prime example of someone motivating his community to get to the polls. For the first time, I feel empowered to galvanize a friend or two. If we can give someone a ride or ensure my friends are voting, this is the time to do it, he said. Oprah called him a model citizen. By that logic, if you bring a friend to the polls, then you are a model citizen in Oprah's book. Goals. Teaching your children about voting might just help save our democracy. Civic engagement begins in the home. Candidates running for political office tend to focus on blocks of eligible voters, Democrats, Republicans, women, evangelicals, and Latinos, to name a few, by tailoring campaign ads and messaging to reach them. But there is one block that even the most experienced candidates can't seem to reach, and it stands nearly 100 million strong. This group of eligible voters massively outnumbers those who voted for Trump, Clinton, or a third party in 2016. The group with the most potential to influence our elections are the ones who don't vote at all. One solid strategy for promoting civic engagement in the next generation of voters? Start at home by engaging your kids in the democratic process. While this unprecedented time can rarely be considered perfect, it is perfect for teaching your kids about voting, especially as we're spending more time at home with them than ever before. Voting is the most accessible and fundamental method of activism we can engage in, and the most effective way to bring political or societal change. Simply encouraging children to vote and giving them the basic tools to do so, like showing them how to register, increases their likelihood of growing up to be dependable voters. The more children who eventually engage in our democracy, the more reflective our politicians will finally be of the people they represent. As an author of a book about motherhood and political activism, it's been impossible for me not to incorporate political engagement with my parenting. To introduce my kids, aged 7 and 5, to the basics of voting, I simply try to lead by example. Come November, we'll repeat a tried and true election routine, one that's changed as they've grown. Back when we were younger, I'd pull them away from their 100th episode of Blue's Clues and explain that it was election day, and I would be taking some time to exercise my right to vote. But now that they've aged out of strollers, I can broach the significance of casting a ballot. This is more than an errand, but the product of fights furiously fought by previous generations. They may have been more excited about the cute "I voted" stickers than the history lesson, but I'll take the small victories. What we do with our children has the potential to affect our democracy in the year 2032, or whenever your kiddo is eligible to vote. Studies indicate that what our children learn before reaching voting age has an impact on lifelong voting habits. Data from Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement of Tufts University shows that 1 in 4 people who weren't taught about voting before they reached the age of 18 chose not to vote because they don't feel knowledgeable enough about the process. Conversely, young people who were taught the basics of voting and encouraged to vote were much more likely to talk to their friends about political issues, volunteer on campaigns, register others to vote, and advocate for policy change. They were also more likely to serve in leadership roles at community organizations and help others in need. Teaching our children about civic duty can make them active participants in our democracy. But how to broach the conversation about the fundamentals of civic engagement without encountering eye rolls? Based on my experience, kids tend to understand as long as you keep it a little less Ken Burns and a little more Schoolhouse Rock. In her new illustrated children's book, Everyone Gets a Say, best-selling author and late-night comedy writer Jill Twiss introducing the concept of voting to children using a saga of woodland creatures. The forest dwellers can't agree on whether to choose the fastest or the fluffiest leader, and so they turn to voting. There's a lot kids don't need to know about politics right now, but one thing that they do need to know is that their voice matters, says Twiss. I wrote Everyone Gets a Say to help kids learn what I think is most important for them to know about voting. That it's a system where the quietest voice matters just as much as the loudest voice. Voting is the one time in our lives where the most powerful among us get exactly the same say as the least powerful. And that is what makes it so special. will get to the Electoral College when they're older. You don't have to dive deep into the nuances of our electoral system. Explain elections in a way that makes sense in your child's world. When I ran for a local political office, I explained to my kids how I want to, among other things, make some improvements to the local parks. With that, they understood that behind the problems they see in their communities, such as the playground's broken swings, elected officials have potential to resolve them. Citizens can use their voices to advocate for the issue they care about by casting a ballot. They may not understand the Affordable Care Act and tax breaks, but they do understand that the playground needs work. Meet them where they are. To demonstrate how voting works beyond Election Day, I introduce a little dinner table democracy. What movie are we going to watch tonight? What restaurant are we getting takeout from tonight? Are we going to the zoo or are we going to the park today? Let's take it to a vote. Even if one kid is disappointed, they do understand that it was a fair system. Hopefully this prepares them for future electoral losses. As we've seen this November, and as we've seen before, elections have consequences. Voter suppression and foreign interference notwithstanding, every single one of us has a voice and the duty to make our voices heard on Election Day. Let's invest in our future by striving to raise future voters who will make their voices heard. This next article is called Armie Hammer Called His Divorce a Seriously Seismic Event. It can be hard to tell which is more transfixing, Armie Hammer on screen or Armie Hammer off screen. Recently, the 34-year-old actor has starred in a string of love stories, most notably Call Me By Your Name in 2017. Now he's playing the troubled and troubling leading man, Maxim De Winter, in the Netflix adaptation of Rebecca. In addition to his high-profile roles, Hammer also makes the news for his own romantic life. In July of 2020, Hammer and his wife of a decade, Elizabeth Chambers, 38, announced their divorce in a joint statement on Instagram. A model and culinary entrepreneur, Chambers is the owner and CEO of Bird Bakery in San Antonio and Dallas, and the host of three Food Network shows. 13 years as best friends, soulmates, partners, and then parents. It has been an incredible journey. But together we've decided to turn the page and move on from our marriage, the caption of the post read. It was a sharp turnaround from Chambers' post only 2 months prior, which celebrated their years together. Happy anniversary, my love. I'm beyond grateful for you, this decade, our family, and the dreamiest Friday night anniversary sunset, she wrote. At the time of the announcement, the couple was quarantining in Grand Cayman with their two children, Harper, 5, and Ford, 3. According to Hammer, quarantine in the Cayman Islands, which had a very strict lockdown, was intense and not in a good way. It was very complicated. It was an intense situation with big personalities all locked into a little tiny place. I just never dealt with anything like that before in my life, so I didn't have the tools. It was just this thing that just snuck up on everybody. I don't think I handled it very well. I think, to be quite frank, I came very close to losing my mind, he told British GQ. After the separation, Hammer returned to LA where he is refurbishing a motel with his friend. Chambers and the children remain in the Cayman Islands where Hammer grew up. In September, Harper and Ford begin their academic year in the same Cayman Islands school that he attended. Though the couple called for privacy in their announcement, Hammer has been open about the emotional toll of the separation. A separation like this is a seriously seismic event in someone's life. And there's a lot of shifting and a lot of growing pains and a lot of changes. Change is a universal constant. I mean, change is not a bad thing always, but that doesn't mean it's painless, he told GQ. According to Hammer, their goal is to go about the separation in a way that affects their children the least. Per court documents, Hammer is filing for joint custody of their children. Until this point, Chambers and Hammer had been open with their love story. They met back in 2006 when Hammer was about 20 and Chambers about 24. She was dating one of his friends, so they remained friends for roughly 2 years. Our friendship continued to grow and grow until one day I was like, I can't be friends with you anymore. You've got to break up with your boyfriend, and we've got to start dating, Hammer told Vulture in 2017. They began dating in 2008 and married in 2010. Hammer didn't see the point in waiting to walk down the aisle. I like the idea of marriage, he told E in 2013. I like the idea that I have a best friend. It's comforting. Chambers echoed similar sentiments while speaking to Town and Country the same year. When we finally got together, Army really wanted to get married. He sat me down and he said, look, we don't have to do this. We could just go our own ways, and then one day you'll be 40 and divorced, and we'll run into each other, and we'll laugh, and we'll go out to dinner, and we'll have the same connection, and we'll wonder why we wasted all that time. Or we could just do it right now and enjoy the ride, Chambers said. The ride, it seems, has reached a new phase. Chambers is moving on with her future. She recently launched a line of face shields for kids, and she's working to raise money for food banks in San Antonio and the Cayman Islands. Her Instagram shows a thriving social life in the Cayman Islands. Hammer, in L.A., is sparking dating rumors with Rumor Willis and Jessica Hernandez. Still, the exes seem to have fond feelings for each other. Chambers wished Hammer a happy birthday on Instagram in August. Happy 34th birthday, Chambers captioned a family photo in her Instagram stories. You are loved. This next article is called This Unsolved Mysteries Episode Might Convince You That Ghosts Are Real. After a tsunami devastated Japan in 2011, survivors reported spirit sightings. One of the most chilling episodes in the second season of Unsolved Mysteries takes viewers to Japan. In March of 2011, a 9.1 magnitude earthquake struck the coast of the mainland. The strength of the earthquake caused a powerful tsunami to strike the area again just 1 hour after the initial rumblings. The tsunami left more than 15,000 people dead and 2,500 missing, according to Japan's Fire and Disaster Management Agency. Understandably, the survivors who lost their homes, loved ones, and oftentimes both, have struggled to cope with the disaster's aftermath. But the fourth episode of Unsolved Mysteries, Tsunami Spirits, uncovers the story of the victims themselves, rather than those who were left behind. According to Unsolved Mysteries, in the months following the tsunami, multiple people reported supernatural encounters, specifically with ghosts, who were looking to find their way home after the disaster. The people interviewed in Unsolved Mysteries are confident that these encounters were real. Below, find a few of the stories described in the episode, and some that were left out. Stories of ghost encounters in taxis left a trail for researchers to follow. Unsolved Mysteries cites the work of a sociology graduate student named Yuka Kudo, who was writing a paper in the months after the tsunami struck. Kudo's professor was impressed with her research, which focused on the experiences of taxicab drivers in the region who were convinced that they had given rides to ghosts. In a 2016 article entitled, In the Months After the Tsunami, Taxi Drivers Report Ghost Passengers in Areas Devastated by 2011 Tsunami, published in the local newspaper, which has since been removed from its site. Kudo spoke to the reporters about her finding of her graduate thesis. The article was screenshot and summarized in a video. In the video, Kudo said she spoke to more than 100 taxicab drivers in the stricken region. While most drivers ignored her, seven were forthcoming with their experiences. One particularly vivid account was the story of a woman who got into a cab months after the tsunami and asked to go to the Miyagi district, which had been completely destroyed. After informing her of Miyagi's destruction, the cab driver admitted that the strange passenger then asked him, "Have I died?" The Unsolved Mystery episode details a similar account. A man around 20 years old, wearing a thick coat, got into a taxi, Kudo's professor said. The driver felt there was something strange about the passenger. By the time they arrived, the sun had already set. When he looked back, the passenger was gone. The professor noted that there were physical records from the trip to follow, which corroborated the driver's stories. In the episode, he theorized that the increased sightings were the result of PTSD. After the tsunami, some thought they were possessed by ghosts. A Buddhist monk worked with people who claimed to be possessed by spirits from the tsunami. He recalled a few stories and unsolved mysteries, but there were even more that were not mentioned. In his book, Ghost of the Tsunami, Death and Life in Japan's Disaster, Richard Lloyd Perry summarizes the experiences of Takashi Ono. That's a pseudonym for a real person. Ono lived miles away from the tsunami. One day he drove to the beach to survey the devastation and was shocked by what he saw. His possession began that night. He came back that evening, sat down for dinner with his family, had his tea, a can of beer, and then began rolling around on the ground, making animal noises, running out into the field behind his house, rolling in the mud, to the horror of his wife and his children. He woke up the next day not knowing anything about this, and this continued for 3 days. He was talking in a strange, guttural way, threatening violence, talking about the dead. His family were beside themselves, and they eventually persuaded him to go to the priest who recited Buddhist sutras and drove out these spirits, and he felt a lot better after that, Perry told NPR. If you don't necessarily believe in ghosts, is there another possible explanation? Perry, who is the Asia editor of the Times of London, did extensive research on the spiritual encounters following the tsunami. His resulting book details the ghost stories from the tsunami disaster zone and seeks an explanation. Grief doesn't resolve anything any more than a blow to the head or a devastating illness. It compounds stress and complication. It multiplies anxiety and tension. It opens fissures into cracks and cracks into gaping chasms, he writes. The sudden loss of life for thousands of people and their families led to gusts of unresolved anguish. This episode of Unsolved Mysteries unpacks the ways that grief can manifest itself. This next article is called Rosario Dawson Says She's in Love with Senator Cory Booker. The two have been dating since October 2018 and confirmed their relationship in March of 2019. In a Washington Post interview, Dawson admitted she's in love with him. The 41-year-old relocated to Newark, New Jersey to move in with Booker, and the two are enjoying the experience of living together, according to a BuzzFeed interview. New Jersey's junior senator, Cory Booker, who previously mounted a campaign as a 2020 Democratic presidential hopeful, certainly... The couple's relationship, which first got started in 2018, has lasted 2 years, and things seem to be getting serious. It's meant a lot to me to know he's running for the highest public office in America, and he's still centering us in our relationship and prioritizing, you know, creating our foundation, Dawson told Extra in April 2019. It's the idea that we can show up for anything that we really want to show up for. And it means a lot to me that in the midst of all of that, he is always willing to show up for us. Booker also told the Washington Post in 2019, "Look, both of us, you know, we've had relationships," Booker said, "but I'm not sure if I've ever fully given myself over to a relationship as much as I have with her and allowed myself to be vulnerable." In fact, the couple has taken a big step in their relationship. Although they've only had a handful of public outings together and the coronavirus has kept them separated for a few months, Dawson revealed in a June 2020 interview that the couple planned on moving in together in Newark, New Jersey, noting that it's time and she's very excited. Things have evidently been going quite well since the move in August. "This is the first time in my life I've really lived with someone. And obviously Rosario and I are enjoying and adjusting to that," Booker revealed in a BuzzFeed interview. To keep you updated on their whirlwind romance, we managed to round up all of the details. In June 2019, while Booker was a guest on the talk show RuPaul, Dawson, who was in the audience, confirmed that she and the senator had been dating since 2018. And after being grilled by RuPaul himself, the politician explained just how they became a couple. "We actually met at a friend of ours that was running for the governor of Maryland," he said. "Ben Jealous is his name, former head of the NAACP. And we met him at a party, and she didn't give me the time of day. She gave me serious shade. But then we re-met at another friend's party months later, and both of us were single at the time, and it was a roof party of a dear friend. And I had the courage to walk up to her and ask her for her phone number." So far, this seems to be a match made in Hollywood, D.C. heaven. Early on in the new year, Page Six reported twice that Booker and Dawson had been spotted out and about on date night in New York City. At one point, the New Jersey senator sat down for a lengthy interview for a popular radio show called The Breakfast Club. And while Booker confidently spoke about policy and the election at length, when the subject of his love life came up, he got a little shy. It all started when Charlemagne the God pointed out that the 2020 candidate, if elected, would be the first president to enter the White House as a bachelor in years. Booker implied that actually that may not be the case. Before I declare president, I'm dating somebody that's really special, he said. Charlemagne countered with, Cory Booker got a boo? The politician shyly replied, I got a boo. Charlemagne continued to push the subject, asking if the girlfriend would make a good first lady and someone he'd potentially marry one day. Yes, Booker said. Oh, please, what have I gotten myself into right now, man? All of these issues we talked about, this is the most uncomfortable part of this interview, he said with a laugh. In March 2019, Rosario confirmed to TMZ that she and Cory were dating. When pressed about her relationship by TMZ while walking through Reagan International Airport, Dawson finally confirmed that she and Booker were in fact an item. He's a wonderful human being. It's good to spend some time together when we can. I'm just grateful to be with someone who I respect and love and admire so much, who's so brilliant and kind and caring and loving. Beautiful words, right? Booker went on the Ellen DeGeneres show and spoke about Rosario. He said, she's a deeply soulful person, and she's taught me a lot of lessons about love already, he said. And sometimes you show the greatest strength when you make yourself vulnerable. And she has this nurturing spirit that's made me more courageous, not just in the love that I project and I want to see in our country, but I think even in our personal relationships, to love more fearlessly. I'm very, very blessed to be with someone that makes me a better person. In a revealing Washington Post profile about Dawson, the actress opened up about her relationship with Booker, which hits its one-year mark in October. Turns out she's absolutely in love, despite initially having no love connection when they first met. For my whole life, I've always felt like, even when I get into a relationship, I was trying to be the center of the storm, and everything was just this maelstrom out there, she said. But for the first time, I feel like I have someone in the center of the storm with me. She went on to reveal that Booker's shy and quirky personality has won her over, along with a handful of dad jokes. The Zombieland Double Tap star also described him as capable, charming, and confident. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ann Jordan, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.